Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument in Betty Parr Russell et al. Versus Ingersoll Rand Company et al. The court is allotted 20 minutes for each side of his argument, and we're ready to hear from petitioners. May it please this honorable court, opposing counsel. Your honors, a person must bring suit not later than 2 years after the date the cause of action accrues in an action for injury resulting in death. The cause of action accrues on the death of the injured person. The language I have just read comes from the current provision in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 16.003B. That language is over a century old. The language is plain and unambiguous, and somehow, through various cases, we have managed to confuse the purpose, the legislative history, the import, and the public policy reasons behind this language. I submit to the court that in this case that we bring before you today, we should clarify the long legislative history and purpose, as well as judicial history, of this statute so that we do not have a result where wrongful death beneficiaries and survival beneficiaries are barred from filing suit where they have no opportunity to file suit before the death of the deceased.
Is this the only example in our jurisprudence, under your argument, of a situation where the deceased, were he or she alive, could not file suit, that the beneficiaries are able to file suit?
I'm sorry.
Well, the statute makes a test for the beneficiaries having any cause of action, and that is if the decedent were still alive, the decedent would have a cause of action. Correct?
Right.
That's been in the law for over a century.
Well, not exactly in that language, and that's part of the problem here.
Okay, but tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, the language from which this derives and from which we just recently changed in 1986 in the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code is where death is caused by wrongful act, neglect, unskillfulness, or default, and the character is such as would, if death had not ensued, have entitled the party injured to maintain an action for such injury. Now, that language then gets repeated that's the original Wrongful Death Act in 1860. That is repeated again in 1879 and corresponded with Article 3202, which is the predecessor of 16003B. It gets repeated again in 1897. It gets repeated again in the Wrongful Death Act that brings us up to date. The importance of that is that until 1986, there was not language as you expressed it. There was language that talked specifically about the wrongful act, neglect, unskillfulness, or default, which was of such character as would have entitled the party injured to maintain an action for such injury. That is where we have gone awry. We have somehow gotten away from that derivative language, which directs us to the underlying tort from which the action derives, as opposed to the person of the deceased from which it derives.
You admit in this case, if the decedent had filed an action timely against Ingersoll Rand, or filed an action before he died, and had taken $1 in damages and executed a full release, that would have barred his survivors from filing this wrongful death and survival action, would it have not?
Depending on the language of the release.
Okay, yeah. If it had been
there have been
language.
Several cases, as you know, which
yeah.
have said that the Wrongful Death Act can survive, and there's one now out of the 14th Court, the Subar case, where there was a personal injury recovery, and thereafter a wrongful death action was filed, and that court has written that the language that we're here about today does not indicate derivation through the person of the deceased, but from the tortious act. Therefore, the Wrongful Death Act may be brought, even after recovery for the personal injury by the deceased.
That's a case that
It's still pending in the court, and it's still knocking around, and I'm sure we'll continue to command attention. But it is a 1991 case, January 1991, out of the 14th Court in Houston. I would direct the court's attention to a little earlier case, however, and that is one that's about a century old, DeHarn versus Mexican National Railway Company, in which that court took the language from the predecessor of 16.003B, the very language we hear about, and said about it that the reason for this provision is obvious. Since no action could be brought by the relatives of the injured person until death has ensued, and since a great length of time might elapse between the injury and the death, it is reasonable that the time of the death should be taken as the point from which limitation should begin to run. The court goes on to talk about derivative actions, that is, derivation through the person as opposed to the tortious act, which again is our controversy here. It clearly says here in 1893, the Texas Supreme Court, that the derivation is from the tortious act, not from the person of the deceased in that case, interpreting the very same language we're dealing with here, the very same statutes in controversy.
So then would it be your position that if the person sues for injuries that have been negligently inflicted on him, he tries that case, wins it, recovers, judgment is paid, and later he dies of complications that arose from the same injuries, that his statutory beneficiaries can then bring a wrongful death action for any damages in addition that they might be entitled to arising out of the same tort?
Of course, that's not this case, but the answer to that is, depending on the wording of the release, I believe that to be the law.
Just a judgment.
Right. And I base that not only on my thinking about it and the Subar case, which says it, but also the case of Landers versus B.F. Goodrich from this court in 1963.
Which in Justice X hypothetical, there is no release. There's just a judgment that's paid.
Yeah, okay, judgment paid, no release. I think there is a cause of action. And I think that is exactly the case in Subar, and I think that is exactly the case in Landers versus B.F. Goodrich, where a survival action was tried and judgment recovered. And the court held a separate and independent wrongful death action likewise could be brought thereafter because they are new and independent action.
Suppose he loses his suit. Can his statutory beneficiaries sue at his death?
And you mean, is that collateral estoppel? Subar says that is collateral estoppel. That has not been adjudicated through Landers because that was not the case there.
Subar,
my position is try to stay out of that one, but but I would think there would be severe issues of collateral estoppel.
Suppose that he only wins half. Suppose that he tries it and he's found to be half negligent and the defendants are half negligent, or there's some allocation of responsibility. Are the statutory beneficiaries free to relitigate that comparative assessment after his death?
Using the same analysis as in Subar, I think collateral estoppel applies. Subar has held, the 14th Court has held, that the liability issues, percentage issues, those issues are not to be relitigated, that they have been determined.
What makes collateral estoppel apply? I mean, in no other area that I can think of, if these were strangers to the suit, the fact that somebody else has lost the determination can bind them. I mean, that can bind the company, but it doesn't bind these other people. So there's some relation that must come about by the statute, does it not? I mean, in some sense, this must be a derivative action.
I agree that, in my opinion, there should be no collateral estoppel at all either way. I'm simply telling the court, in fairness, trying to give you the entirety of the Subar opinion, what that court has held. I don't think there should be a bar. I think it should be relitigated. I think this is a new and independent, completely new and independent cause of action that the wrongful death beneficiary should be entitled to bring.
Is there any jurisdiction in the country that has gone so far in interpreting a Lord Campbell's Act? That's what you just...
I don't know that they've addressed it directly, as has been addressed as directly as the Subar Court has done it, and to some degree the Landers Court here in 1963 addressed it. Not as on the same exact point, but certainly by implication.
one concern is that defenses be treated similarly, and your position on that would be that they should be treated similarly, and that the harmed person's defenses ought not to, whether he has them or he doesn't, whether there are any defenses to his suit, ought not to apply to a suit by a statutory beneficiary just because they apply to him.
No, I'm not sure I'm going that far. I'm saying here, and I don't think we need to go that far here, on all defenses. This defense, a procedural bar by statute of limitations, a radical and terminating defense, is one that has been specifically addressed by the statutory language in the statute of limitations. It says the cause of action does not accrue until his death. So that does not, by implication, mean that all of the other defenses fall. And that's not what the cases seem to say either. I'm just saying that this specific issue, where we're talking about a complete bar to suit of people who had no right to sue until they did, and here these folks sued 35 days after his death, the first opportunity they had to file suit. To bar them from suit is not only unfair and against public expectation, but directly in the face of the statute and the DeHaan case, which interprets the statute.
But if, to be fair, if someone discovered 30 years ago that some product has given him some long-lasting and ultimately terminal disease, and in fact, after years and years and years of treatment, he does die of that disease, if he never chooses to bring suit at any point during that period of time himself, nevertheless, his family can.
That's right. Dead.
Yes.
That is my position. And I think it's, we find other anomalies in the law, whether they be minors or other examples of people who either because of the discovery rule or minority, the tolling or delay in bringing the suit can be lengthy.
Can these causes of action be released before they accrue? In other words, if you feel you're going to be adjudged a tortfeasor in a way that may ultimately prove fatal to someone, can you go out and settle with that person's parents and children while he's still alive if you want to pay off?
All I can tell you is that in every release that is, I'm sure, going through offices these days, there will be people having to sign releases that never had to come in and sign releases before. Now, as to the legal effect of whether you can do that and effectively do it to bar rights, I don't know. But I can assure you that the provisions now, in anticipation of what I think everyone believes to be the right result here, is that people should, you better get releases from the family if death is anticipated. I would jump 100 years from DeHaan and in the interim tell you that the statutory language stayed the same in both those statute of limitations and the Wrongful Death Act, and go to Marino before this court in 1990, where in that court, in that case, of course, as you know, the discovery rule was at issue, and this court held the very statute I'm here telling you means what it says. This court held that statute means what it says. It's plain, unambiguous, and does not allow a discovery rule. Well, here we're not asking for the discovery rule to apply. We're asking this court to repeat what it said in Marino, that the statute means what it says and should be applied as it reads. I don't think any other result can obtain if we're following Marino. Marino comes after all of the litany of cases that I think have confused this issue and have misinterpreted the legislative history. If you go back and look at the statute of limitations, track the wrongful death statute language and see how the derivative language reads up until the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which is not supposed to substantively change the law, but is supposed to defer to the legislative act itself and its history. Until that time, we had no problem with the language, no problem with derivative nature from the person, and therefore bar as unfairly as would apply here.
Will you address Justice O'Connor's statement that on first, initially, her decision, or the decision she authored on behalf of the Court of Appeals, seems to conflict with Moreno, but the questions presented in Moreno are different from the questions presented here. and that's the way she got around Moreno. Would you comment on her analysis?
I was trying to figure out how she got around Moreno, and I didn't. It seemed to me what she was saying was it was a certified question, and therefore wasn't entitled to as much import as it should be given. I don't see how you can distinguish, unless you want to find one more way for someone not to file suit or have a cause of action. There is no way to distinguish Moreno from this situation and come out any differently than I'm asking you to come out. The statute means what it says. Moreno says it does. Justice O'Connor tries to reconcile Moreno, but I don't see how she can. And if you will read her opinion carefully, I don't think she did. So I can't tell you how she distinguished it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Max Rush and Mr. Michael Young will present arguments for respondents. Mr. Max Rush will open.
May it please the court, I will present argument on the wrongful death point of error. As the court understands, this is a summary judgment case. The summary judgment evidence showed that in 1981, Mr. Russell was diagnosed by a physician with having silicosis that was employment-related from sandblasting. In 1982, he filed a lawsuit against numerous defendants, none of which were the respondents in this case. During the following years, he amended his petition several times, adding again additional parties, but still never adding the respondents in this matter. In 1988, he died from silicosis, and 35 days later, the petitioners in this lawsuit filed a wrongful death action. Now, we're not here before this court saying that because they filed 35 days, they're out of court. If it was a Moreno situation, and there was no running of the statute of limitations before the deceased died, then we would agree that they would be here timely and correctly.
Let me give you a hypothetical. A man contracts cancer January 1, 1984. He dies December 31, 1985. His survivors have till December 31, 1987 to bring suit. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
He contracts cancer January 1, 1984 and dies January 2nd, 86. His survivors are out of luck.
Your Honor, that would be our position based on the clear and unambiguous language of 71.003A, the century of case law that has interpreted and applied that statute consistently with the Court of Appeals opinion in this matter.
What was our court thinking of in DeHarn? As best we can tell, I mean, we can't even tell what the name of the
correct,
case is for sure.
Initially, I would point out that in our mind, the language that petitioners rely on in DeHarn is dicta not only in DeHarn, but also in Moreno. In that case, this court was dealing with the extraterritorial effect of the wrongful death action. And in fact, we would cite DeHarn as supporting our position in that after the court analyzed the statute, they found that since Mexican law would apply and Mexican law would not allow a cause of action, then the beneficiaries could likewise not file a cause of action. So it still supported our position that there is a complete and whole derivation of the cause of action.
Certainly, if we do what you're recommending, we ought to go ahead and disapprove the language in DeHarn and the language in Moreno that you refer to as dicta that's not supportive of your position.
Your Honor, I think that the language in DeHarn and that was also quoted in Moreno can be distinguished in that there the court was looking solely at the statutory beneficiaries. There was not a problem with the statute running or a defense being applicable to the deceased that was now being asked to be applied to.
Well, that's why you call it dicta, right?
No, Your Honor. The reason I would quote it as dicta would be that the language does not deal with the extraterritorial matter that was before the court.
But it is language that really conflicts with your position today, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I would not say that it is conflicting.
You don't think it needs to be disapproved?
No, Your Honor. To direct the court's attention to what respondents believe is the statute, 16003B is not the statute to be analyzed in this case. It would be if it was a Moreno-type situation, but the statute in this case to be analyzed and examined is 71.003A. Now, petitioners have come before the court and they tell us that the language drastically changed when it was recodified into the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Our position would be that the legislature, the substance of that statutory provision has not changed since it was enacted in 1860. And to reenact it into 71.03A, the legislature is presumed to have followed the interpretations from this court and the other court, the courts of appeals in this state, that have without exception applied every defense that has been requested to be applied to a beneficiary if it applies to the deceased. And in our brief, we cited numerous defenses, the contributory negligence, the interspousal immunity, the governmental immunity, comparative negligence, guest statute. We've heard some questions from the court today about release and judgment. This court in Thompson, in a case where the injured party filed a lawsuit and settled the lawsuit prior to death, following death, his beneficiaries came in and sued the same defendants. And this court clearly stated there is but one cause of action under the wrongful death statute, and that cause of action belongs to the deceased. What the petitioners are requesting this court to do is to read 16003B as creating a cause of action. But 16003B is nothing more than a statute of limitation, and it applies if the petitioner can carry the hurdle over 71.003A. The first court of appeals in this matter analyzed this case correctly. They looked at 71.003A and they looked at it and they found that we've got to go back and look at the deceased cause of action. Had he survived? Case law from this court and courts of appeals in the state of Texas have showed us about four basic premises. One, the cause of action from a statutory beneficiary is purely derivative. It derives wholly from the deceased cause of action had he survived. Two, a court should then look at the statutory beneficiary's lawsuit as if it was being brought by the deceased. Three, if a defense would have been applicable to the deceased, it is likewise applicable to the statutory beneficiary. And no Texas court has ever drawn a distinction between a substantive and a procedural defense in the context of it being applied through the effect of 71.03A. And lastly, if a deceased could not bring a lawsuit on the date of his death, then likewise the statutory beneficiary can't either.
Some defenses are such that the plaintiff is barred from bringing the suit. That is, it outs the plaintiff from jurisdiction, but the court from having jurisdiction over the plaintiff. And some defenses have to be raised by the defense, or they're waived. Statute of limitations is one of those.
Correct, Judge. And our response to that would be, and to petitioner's argument, is that we're not here telling the court that their cause of action could not have, quote, accrued, unquote. What we're here asking the court to rule is that even though it accrued, it is still subject to a defense. And in this case, it is the statute of limitations.
Is it the plaintiff's burden to prove that there's absolutely no defense that could possibly have been asserted against the decedent, had the decedent been alive, in order to prevail? Or does the new defendant in the wrongful death case have to raise any defense?
Correct, Your Honor. It would be strenuously our position that the defense counsel representing the corporations or entities that were sued by the statutory beneficiaries, it would be incumbent upon them to raise the defense.
None of these other defenses that you raise, and I admit there's this long line of cases that follow just what you say, but none of these other defenses are handled by specific language of the statute, which used to be right there in the same section, like the limitation statute is. I mean, couldn't it be plausibly said that by that being put in, the legislature was intending to treat limitations differently than other defenses were being treated?
Your Honor, our answer to that would be that when the wrongful death statute was originally enacted, the predecessor to 71.03A was in Section 1, and the predecessor to 16.003B was in Section 3. Critical to that placement is that, one, in Section 1, they provided for no exception for Section 3. And in Section 3, they provided for no exception for Section 1. It's our position that the legislature enacts a statute mindful of the effects of one subsection on another. So even though this subsection was specifically stated, it is our contention that the legislature knew that sections, the predecessor to 71.03A, governs, period. And if they can make that hurdle, then we go down to subsection 3, which is now 1603B, and say, if they had a cause of action before they died, then we're giving you a clear two-year period after the date of death. It accrues on the date of death, and you have 2 years to file it in, as long as you had the right to do that by virtue of what the deceased has done for you. The cases in this state that have dealt specifically with this issue are three. One of them is DeLesma versus City of Dallas, wherein the federal district court ruled
None
that...
None of these are, of course, Supreme Court cases.
No, Your Honor, they are not. There are two federal district courts, one Fifth Circuit and one 14th Court of Appeals, which is Davenport. In each of those cases, the critical disposition is that the statute of limitations had expired prior to or on the date of the death of the deceased. The reviewing courts looked at Section 71.003A, read the literal, unambiguous language of that section, applied it directly to the deceased statute of limitations, which is 16.003A, and held that the statutory beneficiaries were barred. One other interesting point about each of those cases, however, is that, one, none of those individuals had filed a suit. In this case, Mr. Russell actively pursued numerous defendants before his death, but never filed against Ingersoll Rand. Number two, each of those reviewing courts specifically addressed the issue that petitioners are raising in this court, and that is the 16003B somehow creates a cause of action rather than just operates as a statute of limitations. Lastly, I would like to direct the court's attention to the policy considerations in this matter. Our position is that the statute of limitations in this state has historically been viewed as a means to provide a defendant with some type of security that litigation will be disposed of in a timely manner while the evidence is still fresh and the witnesses are still alive. We would submit that should this case be allowed to continue, that no defendant will have security. All we're asking for is the court to draw the line that's been drawn in numerous other statute of limitations cases, explaining to the defendant and giving him some type of security as to when the matter will be disposed. If the court has nothing further.
I'm trying to formulate a question. In Marino, we held that because of this statute, because of 16.03, there could be no discovery rule. And if we combine this with the argument which you seek here, adopt Justice O'Connor's reasoning, won't that necessarily result in many of the kind of cases we're seeing now, toxic torts, slow-acting cases, with a complete denial of anybody's rights to sue if an injury is going to result in a death, and won't be another instance where
Judge, I've thought about that. Better to kill somebody than to
merely hurt them.
Right. I have thought about that, and it would be our position that this a ruling in this case in favor of respondents would not be just an industrial tort or a toxic tort type opinion. I think it would have application either way, both ways. If this court were to affirm or reverse, it's going to have effect over personal injury lawsuits where an individual is in a car accident and has a car wreck and is in a coma for 10 years and then dies. Or other types, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think that this opinion can be limited to just slow manifesting diseases that somehow come about years later. In fact, in DeLesma...
No, I'm not saying it does. I'm saying is it not going to result in the possibility of a lot of people never having any opportunity to assert their rights, either a person who's eventually going to die or his survivors.
All right. Answer would be twofold. One, I think it's got to be that way to preserve the integrity of the goals behind the statute of limitations. And two, in response to both your and Justice Heck's questions, the petitioner, I don't think you can settle a lawsuit if it's not this way. I really don't. Even in light of the Reagan versus Vaughn opinion that this court just came out recently on rehearing, I don't think that all of the elements of causes of action and all of the individuals can be effectively settled at the personal injury stage Therefore, you're going to have defendants standing around saying, well, okay, are these people going to die from this injury, and are people going to file lawsuits from that injury? And do I need them in here signing settlement releases and paying money to them?
Any other questions?
Why does the same situation prevail after Reagan v. Vaughn?
I believe Reagan v. Vaughn supports my position here today that there is a derivation of action, and in fact, Justice Gonzalez, in the opinion, pointed out that if there is the defense of statute of limitations applies to the parent, then it would likewise apply to the child. But the point is, in Reagan v. Vaughn, there was an element of damage, mental anguish, which was left out. And I think that a child could perhaps come back now after the death and say, okay, I filed my lawsuit for loss of parental consortium, but I could not file a lawsuit for mental anguish, part of the most recent opinion. Therefore, now I have to wait till after the death to file a lawsuit just for or including mental anguish. So you have a multiplicity of lawsuits as well, I believe.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, to follow up on the answer to the Chief Justice's question, the situation you describe arises if and only if the decedent has slept on his rights prior to his death. That is to say, in the case of a toxic tort, the discovery rule protects the decedent until he learns the fact of his injury. He then has the full statutory period in which to sue, and only if he lets that statutory period go by without bringing suit are his beneficiaries barred by virtue of the statute of limitations. Turning to the survival cause of action, although the survival cause of action has a different statutory underpinning from the wrongful death cause of action, they share a common characteristic. Namely, they are derivative of the deceased's right to bring suit at the time of his death. As to survival actions, we know this for several reasons. First, the very concept of survival. We seldom speak of something surviving an event unless it was alive before that event. In short, survival is not the same as revival. That is confirmed by the statutory language, which speaks of the cause of action not abating because of the death. Here we make no claim that the cause of action abated because of the death. It abated much earlier when the statutory period expired on Mr. Russell's claim with his full knowledge of his injuries. Third, the beneficiaries in a survival action are in direct privity of estate with the deceased. It is the same cause of action as that asserted, or which could be asserted by the deceased, and like anything else where privity applies, it is subject to the same defenses and defeasances as the claim with which it is in privity. And finally, we know this from the case law from this and other courts. We know it from this court's decision in Castleberry, which stated that the survival action is a common law action for damages which could have been instituted by the deceased for injuries resulting in death. We know it from this court's decision in Vassallo, which spoke explicitly of the wrongful death statute, but was simultaneously considering similar arguments with respect to the survival statute. And we know it from the Fifth Circuit's opinion applying Texas law in Delesma. And there, Judge Jerry Williams said that the survival statute does nothing more than preserve for the decedent's estate the causes of action that he held while he lived. The claim that survives the party's death, in other words, also derives solely from the decedent's cause of action. Now, applying that derivative nature to the limitations question in this case, the plaintiff's claims are not barred by Section 16003B. They are barred instead by the survival statute, Section 71021A, because the deceased had no cause of action to survive as of the time of his death. This court has recently dealt with this derivative limitations question in another context, and I'm referring to this court's opinion 2 weeks ago on motion for rehearing in Reagan v. Vaughn. And the court there said, first of all, that the cause of action in Reagan v. Vaughn was a derivative cause of action, and the defenses which bar all or part of the injured parent's recovery have the same effect on the child's recovery. And then the court had to deal with the question of retroactivity, and it said Reagan v. Vaughn would apply in the pending case, all cases arising thereafter, and to existing cases not in the judicial process, derived from a parent's claim so long as the parent's claim had not been extinguished by settlement, final judgment on appeal, or, lo and behold, expiration of the statute of limitations. These are all procedural defenses, but they are procedural defenses which apparently this court recognizes to derivatively bar those claims that are based on the Reagan versus Vaughn cause of action. And for that reason, Your Honor, we believe that the statutes can be reconciled and must be reconciled by this court by holding, as Justice O'Connor said, that Section 16003 governs the timing of a cause of action, and Section 71003 and 71021 govern the basic existence of a cause of action. In my last few seconds, let me deal briefly with the constitutional issues. The open court's challenge in this case is squarely foreclosed by the Moreno decision and by this court's Rose decision, which hold that the open court's provision has no applicability to a statutory cause of action, but only to a well-recognized common law cause of action. Of course, neither wrongful death nor survival were well-recognized common law causes of action. The other constitutional challenges were simply not raised below and are not before this court for consideration. They were not raised in the Rule 166AC summary judgment response. They were not raised in the Court of Appeals until rehearing, and they are untimely and not properly before the court. If the court has no questions, that concludes my presentation.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
In focusing on the crucial issue here of derivation of the right to sue, whether the rights of the survivors are completely, wholly derivative of the person of the deceased as contended by the respondents, I would go back to Moreno and ask this question. The decedents were children. They had an unlimited statute of limitations until age 18. There was no statute of limitations that could have barred suits by those children for their injuries through their proper next parent. They died in 1981, I believe it was, of Reye syndrome. The parents sued in 1985 and had to resort to the discovery rule to attempt to get around the bar of the statute of limitations. If these rights are derivative from the person of the deceased, why were the parents not allowed to bring suit using the tolling of the statute of limitations from minority from the children? Why? They're out of court. They resort to the discovery rule, and the answer to the discovery rule is the statute means what it says. We've considered the derivative nature. We've considered this statute. It's the statute of limitations. It bars suit because it means what it says, and it says is that you bring a cause of action within 2 years from the date the cause of action accrues. And this statute says the cause of action accrues upon the death of the deceased. Now we try to run it further full circle so that that language no longer means what it says. The language in DeHaan about 100 years ago talks about this derivative question. And they illustrate what they mean in the very statutes that are being used purportedly by respondents here, where it is clear that the derivative nature they're talking about is from the wrongful act. It is derivative of the wrongful act. The DeHaan court says, in order to illustrate what is derivative, they talk about the fellow servant rule. And they go for a paragraph talking about the fellow servant rule and whether the survivors would have a right to bring the suit if one state allowed recovery if a fellow servant was negligent and another did not. That was exactly what followed the discussion of the predecessor of this statute of limitations we're here about, Article 3202, the same language we're here about. That shows the distinction and the reason why the DeHaan court was so strong in its position that 3202 certainly would not ever bar an action by someone who had no opportunity to bring it before the decedent's cause of action was barred by limitations. It was very clear in that discussion what the legislation at that time, the very basis for why we're here today, meant. The court interpreted it. The statutes were repeated in the same language in 1879 and again in 1897 and again in 1925. The same language right down the road until 1986 when there's a little twist to the language in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and I agree, it did not change anything. That language can't change anything. It goes back to from whence it came. It cannot change the legislative intent nor language, and it did not. We have simply misinterpreted it somehow, and I ask this court to please straighten it out. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.